The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Monday night, another Heretic's Hour. 2 hours of controversial conversation by yours truly, Carolyn Yeager. I will be on my own again tonight, but I have plenty to say. Today is October 1st. We are out of summer and into autumn. 3 more months of this year is all there is, and we'll be in 2013 already. Here in my neck of the woods, we've been having rain and cool temperatures. It's just been great. I do like when the summer is over, since I live in the South. My topics tonight are more about circumcision in the first hour, and then I'll speak on patriarchy and the new right in the second hour. I'll work up my courage to get warmed up for that during this hour. I did not send out any announcements for this show tonight. I've been very busy. Plus, I have some problems sometimes with my website still, off and on, and I just got discouraged about it. And not so much discouraged, but I also thought, why do I need to send those out? I'm sure it helps because I send out over 300, and then another 100 and some over 100, on a discussion group I'm on. But I thought I'm going to stop doing that for a while and see how it works. And I didn't even put an announcement on, the White Network this afternoon for the show. So I'm going to see if it really affects the amount of live listeners I get. So far it has. but other shows don't send out announcements, and people need to know, they should know by now that this show is going to be on, never fails, on Monday at 9 Eastern. So that's the story about why nobody got any announcements. And I don't think I'm going to be sending any out for a while, so don't expect to get them. My topics tonight, I already told you that. Okay, and before I begin on tonight's topics, of circumcision in the first hour, I'm going to have a short diversion here. It so happens that 2 days from now, on October 3rd, is the 70th anniversary of man's first rocket into space. From Houston? No, indeed. From Peenemünde, in the midst of Germany's expansive northern coast. The year was 1942, when British aerial bombardment was devastating whole cities, straining the German economy. In retaliation, Dr. Werner von Braun, the same von Braun that was responsible for launching the Saturn V rocket that sent American men to the moon, Dr. von Braun and his team developed the V-2, called the retaliation weapon. The older V-1 had been called the buzz bomb. On Saturday, October 3rd, 1942, a V-2 burst from Earth's atmosphere into space. General Walter Dornberger, military commander of the rocket installation at Peenemünde, said to von Braun, "Do you know what we accomplished today? Today, the spaceship was born." This year, 2012, is also the 100th anniversary of von Braun's birth, back on March 23rd, is when it occurred. And for this occasion, there was no commemorative postage stamp issued by the Jewish captivated government of the United States to the man who put the U.S. on the moon. So for this information that I just gave you, I thank Jim Lowe and his FLAC newsletter mailed out from Fredericksburg, Texas, always full of good pieces of information that I miss because I don't read the New York Times like he does. So he sees all this stuff. And he reminds us that Stalin's successors still occupy von Braun's birthplace in Prussia. Okay. Now, on to the circumcision expose, or more of it. First, I want to make a correction from last week. You know, I knew when I said it had to be wrong, but I just didn't want to stop and start, and, you know, I would have had to look something up, and, you know, I would have had to think about it. And, but I knew when I said that, you got 63 ounces of Skin Medica, skin product made from expensive infant foreskins for $114. And I said, well, 63 ounces really isn't very much, because I knew it wasn't very much that you got for that, but, that wasn't quite right, folks. I looked that up, and of course, it is 0.63 ounce, that you get for $165. The TNS Recovery Complex Skin Rejuvenation Treatment with the highest levels of patented growth factor. You know where that comes from. Sells for $165 for 0.63 ounces. That's not too much. But that's generally how these expensive creams go. They put them in little jars and things and containers that look bigger than they really are. And there's not that much, there's very little in there. But then they also have the TNS Essential Serum, which they call is full strength TNS. For $250, you can get 1 ounce of this. And for sure, Oprah and Babwa Walters use it themselves, and they don't care how it's made. You know, anything that works for these wealthy women, that's what they want. They want to believe, therefore, that circumcision is a good practice, because people with a vested interest are just like those with a religious bias, in that, you know, they want to think that because it's something that they are going to do, or they feel like they have to do, that they want to believe that there's a good reason for it. So I'm going to read about religious bias right now, and this is really taken from that CircLeaks page that I told you about last week, which is once again www.circleaks.org. CircLeaks is spelled CIRCLEAKS. And what I'm talking about tonight comes mostly from there. As I said, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and I could use it for quite a while. So just because we're talking about how I just mentioned here how people like Oprah and Barbara Walters probably tell themselves that this is a good practice, and so it's okay to use this product, use babies' foreskins and other things like that for their beauty products. It's also, they say, cultural or religious importance to circumcision may predispose one to view the practice of circumcision in a positive light. Well, naturally. And to welcome evidence that it is medically beneficial, perhaps even necessary or required, and to dismiss arguments and research to the contrary. And so you know that a lot, the reason this is meaningful is that a whole lot of the people promoting circumcision are Jewish. I mean, the vast majority are Jewish. And of course it goes with they're justifying their religious practice, because what we hope here, what I hope in doing these shows, and what I hope you will help to, you know, add whatever you can, and you should be doing so, effort to bring about a ban on circumcision in white countries, to bring about an end to it. And this is what they're very afraid of course. So they have always been trying to make it something that everybody accepts and everybody does, so that it won't be banned for them to do, because they don't want to leave our countries. That's the bottom line there. They want to stay here because they're doing very well in all of our countries. So they want to be able to practice their beliefs and religions totally freely without any kind of restraint whatsoever. So it says, like anyone else, a scientist or researcher, many of these are researchers into circumcision, they may have a bias in favor of circumcision if she or he adheres to a religion where circumcision is a religious requirement. A religious bias is a conflict of interest. So these people all have a conflict of interest in doing this work, because reporting accurate findings in studies regarding circumcision is at odds with a conviction to defend what has been a historically controversial and ethically problematic religious practice. Circumcision is viewed as a religious requirement in Judaism. It is also considered an important religious tenet in Islam by many, though it is not mentioned in the Quran. Not all adherents of Islam are circumcised or consider circumcision to be a requirement. That's not true of Jews, though. People in some sects of Christianity, such as Coptic Christians, consider circumcision to be a religious requirement, though it is expressly forbidden to Gentiles in Galatians 5. I'm going to read that. The Coptic Christians are mostly in Egypt. There are 18 million Coptics in the world, and by far the most of them are in Egypt. So that's the kind of Christians they have there, and they believe in circumcision and practice it. Now, in the Bible, the most important passage in the New Testament that talks about circumcision, and it came up a little bit in my first program 2 weeks ago, but I'm going to read the whole thing here in Galatians 5, starting at verse 2. And I'll go from verse 2 through verse 6, and then I'll jump to verse 11. Mark my words. I, Paul, tell you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all. Again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law. That is, if you follow the law of circumcision, then you better obey the whole law. That's how I interpret that. Going on with verse 4, you who are trying to be justified by the law have been alienated from Christ. You have fallen away from grace. For through the Spirit we eagerly await by faith the righteousness for which we hope. For in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. And then jumping to verse 11, mentions it again, and says, brothers and sisters, if I am still preaching circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? In that case, the offense of the cross has been abolished. Then verse 12, as for those agitators, I wish they would go the whole way and emasculate themselves. With an exclamation mark. Boy, he was a little bit angry. He's fed up with these circumcision agitators, obviously, and he says he wishes they would just go the whole way and emasculate themselves. So there is no command whatsoever for Christians. If you are a Christian and you think that Christians should be circumcised, because it says in the Bible that Jesus was circumcised, there is no command whatsoever from either Jesus or from his disciples or Paul that Christians should be circumcised. And in fact, it gets in the way if it's considered to be following some kind of law which is outdated and is not necessary, and means that you're not taking it all by faith and belief. So a little bit more here. Circumcision is an important, often indispensable religious custom for many religious people, and attempts to question its propriety are often seen as blasphemous. So this becomes, it becomes a religious issue, certainly not scientific. Yet there is a recognition that medical validity is important to maintain justification for the surgery. Well, yeah, and that's why they're looking for medical validity for it. And that's what we've been talking about. So today, I want to take a closer look at the NIH. I just mentioned them last week as one of the four main institutions that link circumcision recommendation based on HIV/AIDS prevention. And the National Institutes of Health, which is the letters for that is NIH, is a part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Now, we've all heard that. You know, whether we know much about it, who has not heard the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services? It's just part of the background noise of our life here in the United States. And it is the nation's medical research agency. Now, you know, when I read that, I think about, right away, I think about the things that are said about National Socialist Medical Research, the things that have been said about the so-called Nazis, the Third Reich, and that they carried out some medical research. And, oh, you just use the words medical research in connection with National Socialists or Third Reich, and it's just evil stuff, you know, taking people against their will and doing research on them, and they, you know, atrocious results. And we know what all the Holocaust survivors have, so-called survivors, have written about it, you know, big lies. But, you know, the United States has this Department of Health and Human Services for medical research that is beyond anything that national poor little Germany ever dreamed of, you know, of having and or doing. And the NIH is the largest source, in fact, of funding for medical research in the world, made up, and it's made up of 27 institutes and centers all over. And the four that we're mostly concerned with as far as circumcision goes is NIAID, which is National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. That AID doesn't stand for AIDS, it stands for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And of course, HIV/AIDS is considered an infectious disease, and so that they're very much involved in AIDS research and so on. And the NCI, which is the National Cancer Institute, and it used to be that for circumcision, the National Cancer Institute was very involved because they came up with the idea that circumcision could help prevent penile cancer. I guess that's how it's said. You know, cancer of the penis. You know, how, as I've brought up before, how many people have ever heard or of anybody ever getting that? And certainly not babies and young kids. So if you would, well, it just doesn't, there is no connection, but they were using that then until the AIDS thing came up. And now they switched over to that, but the Cancer Institute is still somewhat involved. And then they have the NICHD, which is the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Child Health and Human Development, I've heard of that so many times. And this is has Eunice Kennedy Shriver's name on it, so I guess she probably funded it, endowed it with a lot of her money, and so her name is on there. And then the fourth one is the FIC, which is the Fogarty International Center for advanced study in the health sciences. So this is just advanced study internationally, and it's named for John E. Fogarty. Now, these are four of the 27 institutes that make up the National Institute, the NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health. And the money has a huge budget. The money comes from the U.S. government. Of course, you know, our money, tax money, you know, I don't know. You think there wouldn't be enough tax money for all the money that the U.S. government spends, which is true. But there's a lot more than income taxes. They take in so much taxes of all kinds of things. Anyway, it's the U.S. government, and we're the U.S. government, supposedly. So from the money that the U.S. government can collect in all the various ways and churn out, $31 billion annually goes into medical research. And they say for the American people. But this stuff is all over the world. They're doing a lot of work in Africa for Africans. So this is not for the American people. But they say that, you know, the NIH invests $30.9 billion annually in medical research for the American people. So we're supposed to be getting something back for all that money that they steal. Think of how much money people would have if the government wasn't taking it all for one reason or another. Now, more than 80% of the NIH's funding is awarded through of this $31 billion, you know, is awarded through grants to more than 300,000 researchers at more than 2,500 universities, medical schools, and other research institutions in every state and around the world. So our money is going around the world because people have written up grant requests and they have all this money to give out. So if you have a decent request, they'll send the money to you. 2,500 universities and medical schools are using this money. And we know how they're all funded by the government. So, you know, grant, there's all kinds of grant money. But I don't, most of us never think about writing something up, some project, and applying for a grant. When I was teaching, there was a high school girl. She's a pretty smart girl. She had learned about grant writing, and she had already gotten one grant, and she was working on another one. She was only in high school, and she was telling me about it, but, you know, I just didn't have any reason or impulse to, you know, ask for money for something that I didn't have anything to do. But, you know, who does? Jews. Jews are fantastic at getting government money, and they write probably most of these grants. And then, of course, medical people know all about it, so they just have to put it in writing, and then the government gives them all that money. And then that's 80% of it goes there, and about 10% supports projects in their own laboratories. They have 6,000 scientists in their own laboratories, most of which are on the NIH campus in Bethesda, Maryland. Huge place, huge landmass there, and all for them. So, well, no, maybe it's not huge. I'm thinking about the CIA. I was looking up the CIA this afternoon. But anyway, they have a campus in Bethesda, Maryland. So the next thing I want to bring up is that I mentioned last week and the randomized clinical trials, which have been done in Africa. These are the RCTs. And there have been three major ones done in Africa by circumcision proponents, and to discover how effective circumcision is in reducing or preventing or whatever HIV/AIDS. And the one was done in Orange Farm, South Africa, under the supervision of French circumcision proponent Bertrand Auvert. If you were listening last week, or if you might recall that I mentioned him, and I talked about him a little bit, he is the one who works with Bill Gates, good friend of Bill Gates, and actually works for his foundation. Or I don't know if you'd say he works for his foundation. The foundation hires him to do all these research projects for them. They may be the ones who get the money from the government to do it. And he's one of their experts and great friends with Bill Gates. And I told you I didn't like his looks. He's been a circumcision proponent for something like, oh, I think they said 2003 or 2006. I can look all these people up. I will be looking at these names in a little bit. But right now I just want to cover a little more here. The second RCT, randomized clinical trial in Africa, was done in Kenya under the supervision of North American circumcision proponent Robert C. Bailey and Stephen Moses. We haven't talked about them yet, but I'll just mention first the third one was done in Uganda under the supervision of North American circumcision proponent Ronald H. Gray. I did talk to you a little about Ronald Gray last week, and he's associated with all these, with Bill Gates and, you know, all these people. And he's married to, what was her last name, is Wawer. I'm going to go to that page now. And they have a clinic together. And they do circumcisions and they do circumcision research. Her name is Maria J. Wauer, and she and her husband, Ronald Gray, I couldn't tell if they were Jewish. They're kind of, they could very well be, but, you know, it's one of those hidden things if they are. So, but the, we haven't talked about Robert Bailey and Stephen Moses yet, so I'm going to, let's go to them. And Robert Bailey is a fairly youngish-looking guy, but probably he could be even 50, though, in this picture. You don't know how old the picture is, but he is creepy-looking, too. But, you know, I mean, it all depends on what you're, what you know about him, I guess. He's professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois at Chicago, and he's a research associate at the Field Museum. You know, all these places that are always, that are tied in with the government and, would never accuse the government of anything. You know, they know where their bread is buttered and what they can say and what they can't say. And he's been, this guy has been a circumcision proponent since at least 1998. He's associated with a lot of Jews. I don't know if he's Jewish. You know, just because his name is Bailey doesn't mean he's not, but he doesn't actually look it. So, you know, I don't want to be just throwing that all around at people. Most of the people on this page are Jewish, but some of them aren't. He was responsible, but he works with Stephen Moses, who is Jewish. They talk about the trial he did and how these trials are used by the World Health Organization under the guidance of UNAIDS. I've talked about some of that. And Bailey is associated with the Gilgal Society, which I will say a little more about. There's something here about deceptive. In his trial that he oversaw, he has admitted that repeated study visits and intensive behavior counseling of the circumcised men were needed to reduce risk behaviors. So, you know, they come up with results that say, excuse me, that say, oh yeah, it's, you know, it helps. It helps. There is less HIV/AIDS in the group that we circumcised than in the other, or things like that. But actually, studies have shown the opposite in among Africans, and this one was in, I think, Swaziland. I'll probably come upon it somewhere here in the rest of the hour. But one of them, in which the actual results of the trial, this wasn't one of these three, but the results of the research they did, was that the uncircumcised men had less HIV/AIDS than the circumcised men. But they still said the opposite, you know. They said, oh, it helps prevent it and so on. So this is just how dishonest these people are. They really, and they get away with it because nobody, you know, the media or whoever, or the medical establishment or the government or anything, nobody's, they're all collaborating in this. So they're not going to look for, you know, they're not going to bring any of this out. You just have to know it, and you have to make, you know, try to get other people to understand it. Now, where is Samuel, what's his name? Stephen Moses. Let's find him. I look for the M's, I guess. Yeah, here he is. Stephen Moses is, naturally, he's Jewish. He's a professor in the Department of Medical Microbiology in Community Health Sciences and Medicine, whatever that means. He's been a circumcision proponent since 1994, and he, along with this Bailey we just talked about, was responsible for one of those three African trials. Just say the same thing there. See if I can find something interesting about him. Well, there's a lot of comments about him, but I'm not going to go through that. Just the thing is, he is definitely Jewish, and he's definitely pro-circumcision, and, you know, he's a recognized expert. And he is also associates with the Gilgal Society and the Circlus Society. Now, this gets to be really sick stuff. And so I think it's time that I mention the Gilgal Society. So for that, I'm going to go, it doesn't take but a second to do this, but I'm going to go back out of people and go back into, I think it's in organizations, and look up the Gilgal Society. Click on that. And here we have, this is weird. And, you know, I should have probably talked about this Vernon Quaintance, but I'll talk about the society that he started first, and then I'll go back and talk about him. Because he's on the first page of this, and he's probably one of the most egregious of all these people. Well, maybe just the most foolish, I don't know. Maybe not the most egregious, because he's not the most important. But he is Jewish, and Vernon Quaintance. Vernon Quaintance started the, it owns the Gilgal Society. He founded it. But it's a British-based not-for-profit organization, and it's administered by this Vernon Quaintance, and it's Gilgal is Hebrew for Hill of Foreskins. Remember in the first show, I was reading that stuff, that material from the old religious beliefs and so on, the biblical passages and what have you from that website, and they talked about the Hill of Foreskins. That was, I think, after they came out of the 40, wandering the 40 days, and they went, and they were not able to do any circumcisions. And was it, what am I talking about? 40 years, I guess. 40 years, and in the wilderness. And then they, at the end of that, Moses ordered everyone to go up on this hill, all the men and boys, and they did a circumcision on all of them, all at the same time. From all that 40 years that it had not been done. And they call that Gilgal, Hill of Foreskins. And the logo, you can see it here for the Gilgal Society, is a curvy line. And it says that it's a smoke trail from burning foreskins. And this is biblical because supposedly they burned the foreskins. And, you know, with the Jews, they have this thing about burning. They have to have a holocaust. They have to burn things, you know, to satisfy their ritual type, myths and so on. And so that's how this works. Now this society, admits to a morbid fascination with circumcision to the point of sadomasochistic fetish. The Gilgal Society, along with the Acorn Society and the Cutting Club, they kind of throw together here, and they say they advertise that doctors are among their members, and they try to make it kind of scientific, and they say that those on the internet who discuss there are those on the internet who discuss the erotic stimulation they experience by watching other males being circumcised. They swap fiction and about it, and they trade videotapes of actual circumcisions. They are fascinated with watching other men be circumcised, and this very fetishistic. And the Circlist Club. On that page, they had some links, and I read something that someone had written. He had gone with these two young boys around the age of 15, 16 or so, who had some kind of a medical problem with their uncircumcised penises, so they were going to be circumcised. And they said that one of them, his mother approved, but his father had not been told about it at all. Maybe they thought they would never tell him, he would never know. It was their some physical education instructor named Mike who they talked to about this and who arranged them to be circumcised and who went with them and did all this stuff. And then he wrote he said he set up his cameras and everything, so he was photographing it. They were both done, you know, separately, and he described in detail, what took place. I mean, from the minute even before they got there, to the way they felt and the way they looked and acted and how they, you know, how they got undressed and how they laid down and how they reacted to the to the operation and on and on. And then he said, well, he had a couple even younger kids in a month or so that he was going to accompany, and he would let them know about those later. So this is the kind of stuff that they pass back and forth in these groups, like the Gilgal Society, that was the Circlist Society, and so on. And this guy, Vernon Quaintance, well, they have a bunch of names here. They have porn. They say, here's an example of Gilgal porn. I probably shouldn't. Yeah, this is the one I read. I went and read this whole thing. You can find it on here. It's about published by the Gilgal Society. It's about what are these two boys' name was Mark and Neil. Anyway, so I'm going to go back to this organization page, and I'm going to go to the there's a cutting club. Where's the Circlist? Circlist. Okay. They're a weird group. Vernon Quaintance is a member of that too, along with Jake Waskett, who's another weird guy. There's some people I'm going to talk about here. It says Circlist is a website and a discussion group for men who sexually fantasize about performing and receiving circumcisions, often on small children. A few well-known Circlist members include Vernon Quaintance and Jake Waskett. There's pages on these two men. Professor Brian J. Morris, Dr. Edgar J. Schern, and researcher Daniel T. Halperin associate with the Circlist. And they just pretty much say the same kind of stuff. But, it surprised me. I had no idea. Of course, you know, there's this kind of stuff for everything. I mean, there's so much sex that most middle class people just don't know about that going on. Sex can become such a turn on that people, once they get started with it, it's an addiction, and they can't get away from it. So they just keep going, and they try to make it seem normal. Just like they try to make pornography seem normal. Well, it's a healthy thing for men, even women, you know. What makes it healthy, I don't know, but that's just the way they want to show it. Now I'm going to go back to the front page, I guess, and find what they're saying about this acquaintance. He was arrested recently. Most of these people get away with everything, but this guy, he was caught with child porn. Police raided, I'm going to go to the story. Police raided his home on a tip, and they found a bunch of videos. They call it child porn. Video cassettes with 9 hours worth of clips showing boys as young as 11 engaging in sex acts. This guy, Vernon Quaintance, who is so involved in all these circumcision clubs and so on, is 68 years old, heads the Gilgal Society, and in his home they found they found a box. And in the box were all these movies. And then they seized 5 tapes, and 3 were found to contain indecent images, you know. They comprised a total of 7 to 9 hours. Anyway, the children were between 11 and 16. And his defending attorney said that, well, the videotapes were in a box in his office, and they were the films from the 70s and 80s, and he accepts, Mr. Quaintance accepts that was material that he had looked at the time, but that was like 40 years ago, and they were just still in this box in his office that he never looked at over all these years, you know, putting the best face on it. And how can you prove otherwise? But he was given a 40-week jail term, suspended for 2 years, ordered to complete a sexual offender's rehabilitation course. Well, you know, those things don't change anything. They don't do any good. They're just, that, you know, they just go through the motions there. And he had to pay £300 in court costs. So he got a suspended sentence, has to go to a, you know, course, and cost him £300. Not much, although they didn't have all that much against him. But, you know, he is known to be a circumcision fetishist, and is on all these sites and clubs that where they talk about it and exchange their videos and their writings. They, you know, they describe what they see and how they feel and so on while they're watching all this stuff and how the boys are. And it's just amazing. You know, it's amazing what they all do. Now, I'm going to go back. So, this Jake Waskett, he's another weird one. They have him on the front page, too. He's a member of the Circlist, and I'm going to go to his page. What's different about him is that he spends a great deal of time editing Wikipedia on the circumcision pages to show a pro-circumcision bias. In 2011, as of early 2011, he had made 14,000 edits and more than 1,275 to the circumcision article alone. I guess he looks around for any articles that have anything about it and tries to, you know, put things in there that might make it more pro-circumcision. His first edit was done in October 2004, and his last edit, they say, was today, whenever this was written. He averages about one edit every one day, 20 hours, 29 minutes, and he's known to lurk in parenting forums. He lurks in parenting forums and blogs attempting to convince expectant parents to circumcise. So if you're in any of these forums or discussion groups and there's somebody there acting like an expert who's telling you, you know, not to believe this, not to believe that, and how good circumcision is, it could be somebody like this creep who doesn't, you know, he looks creepy. I mean, well, I suppose if you didn't know what he was doing, you wouldn't have any decision one way or the other. But, and he says that what these people do on the internet, they discuss the erotic stimulation they experience by watching other males being circumcised. They swap fiction about it and trade videotapes. Well, that's about it. They're called circumfetishists, and they're known because I don't know. At least these people are known. I imagine there's people that go there and don't want to be known to see what it's all about. Maybe they get caught up in it, maybe they don't. So I'm going to go back to the people page and look at some of these other people. You know, I was just doing that yesterday. I was just clicking on names and just, oh, here's Douglas DeKima. Let's look at him. He works with a partner. He's worked with Susan Blank and Andrew Friedman on the AAP Circumcision Task Force 2012. He's a pediatric bioethicist. And he looks Jewish. I don't know. He looks like he is, but I don't know what he is. He's attending physician and director of education for the Truman Katz Center for Pediatric Bioethics, at Seattle Children's Hospital. Now, anything named Katz, K-A-T-Z, is Jewish. I know of quite a few Katzes that I've come across in my researches. They're all Jewish, so I imagine this center was named for a Jew. They funded it. And he's in the Seattle area. And this is what's so interesting about him. He caused controversy by advocating a ritual nick of the clitoris of young girls. Okay, before I go into that, I want to talk about his two partners. One is Susan Blank. She is, it's hard to tell what she is either. Blank could easily be a Jewish name, and she looks kind of Jewish, but then she could be, so there's a lot of people that are definitely Jewish on here, but I'm picking these ones that don't have such Jewish names. Could be Slavic or even Irish or who knows, or a mixture of all kinds of things, but she's a white person, unless she is Jewish. And, she though is from New York, so, she was the chairwoman of this task force. 2012, just this year, 2012, AAP, American Association of Pediatrics Task Force on Circumcision. This is where they were going to come out with a decision on whether they would recommend circumcision or not. I talked about this probably in the first program. And they released a new policy statement on August 27th, just last month, a little over a month ago. I don't know. I think I must have read about it. It must have been on one of these programs where this is where they said they came out mildly in favor. The Americans did. They came out in favor of circumcision, but said that it wasn't really strong and it was really up to the parents. You know, the parents could decide what they wanted, but they thought that they had a bias on the side of doing circumcision for your little boy rather than not doing it. I remember that now. And so she worked for the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene since 1992. And she's also affiliated with the Center for Disease Control, which is another one of these terrible government health medicine agencies, and the DOHMH, Department of Health and MH Health. I don't know. One of those government departments for medicine. And she's currently director and assistant commissioner of the Bureau for STD Control, you know, sexually transmitted diseases. So this is what gets her into, and she appears to be convinced of the medical advantages of circumcision. So she's a proponent of it. And the other person in this group was, I forgot that. Who was the other guy's name? Let's see. Let's go back to her. Well, I will go back to, Friedman. Yeah, Friedman. Let's see, where is he? Andrew Friedman was also part of this task force. Oh, he's a winner. He's a urologist at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. He's definitely Jewish, even says he is. He was on this task force for the AAP, which came out mildly on the side of circumcision. And he has CircLeak says he has a religious conflict of interest because not only is he Jewish, but he has a son. These people are really something. He has a son whom he circumcised himself on his parents' kitchen table on his eighth day of life. But this is not he's not the one who, there was the other guy who got in trouble. He's not a circumciser. He's a urologist, but anyway, I guess he knows something about that. So he, according to Friedman, the AAP did not incorporate recommendations on mitzvah bep, which is the Jewish tradition of oral suction of the wound of a circumcised baby's penis, because the AAP Task Force on Circumcision, of which he was a part, reasoned that there are too few done and practitioners of the tradition will continue whether the AAP recommended against it or not. So, you know, he was influential on having the AAP not say anything about that, not have take any position on this oral suction of the after the penis, after the foreskin is removed, and it's actually a bleeding wound there, because for these reasons that it won't do any good, you know, because these practitioners are going to do it anyway. Doesn't matter whether the AAP recommends it. So he didn't think the AAP should take a position on it, because it's a religious thing anyway, and so they didn't. And he also, this guy, he works with the Mohel, who practices this, only he uses a tube in order to prevent genital contact. He says, here's what he says about circumcising his son. He says, I circumcised him myself on my parents' kitchen table on the eighth day of his life. But I did it for religious, not medical reasons. I did it because I had 3,000 years of ancestors looking over my shoulders. Okay, that's the power of the Jewish tradition, of that, of this Jewish tradition on Jews, even if they're doctors and so on, and they might know that it's not medically necessary. But he admitted that he did it because of all his Jewish ancestors looking at him and pointing the finger at him. Now, I want to go back to, I forget where I was, who that first guy was now. Darn, you'd think I could recognize his name here. But so far I haven't. Boy, there's some... Oh, Dikema, yeah, I remember now. All right, this Dikema, Douglas Dikema, I already said some things about him. I have to go to this story, I guess, because it's, yeah. See if I can bring this story up. Okay. Here's a strange thing. I just have time in the last few minutes here that this man caused a storm in I think it was in Australia, but when he came out with recommending on some committee he was on that the committee was deciding whether to what to do about circumcising girls. And here is the deal. The committee stressed the need for doctors to counsel parents. I don't know quite where to start with this. What it is, I'll just say it. I can say it better. They have a lot of Muslim families, and these Muslims come to these doctors, these pediatricians, and they want to have their girls circumcised here in the United States by them, and because they think it's safer and more hygienic. And when they it's against the law in the United States. And when they say no, here's what these some of these people will say. They say, well, if you won't do it here. Okay, we had families explicitly tell pediatricians that if we did nothing, they would take their kids back to Africa. These are Africans. Back to Africa, where they would not have control over how harmful a procedure was done. Dr. Dikema said what they needed was something that satisfied what they believed were the demands of their religion. So he came up with the idea that that in the United States, people like him could put a nick, what he called a nick, on the girl's clitoris, which would, he says, would be less intrusive than infant male circumcision. Well, infant male circumcision is very intrusive because they remove a large piece of skin, which is a part of the whole thing. But Dikema says we would remove no tissue, would not touch any significant organ, but rather it would It would be a small nick of the clitoral hood, which is the equivalent of the male foreskin. Nothing that would scar, nothing that would do damage. Well, you know, I have to think that by nick, he means to cut something away, you know, a small part. Cut away a small part of the clitoral hood. And it wouldn't be anything like what they do in Africa, but it might satisfy these parents who feel like they are under a religious obligation to have this done to their daughters. And but this is like blackmail, sort of, you know. And that why these American non-Muslim, non-African doctors and so on think that they need to cater to these people and their religious rituals when it is something that we have decided is against the law here. But they say, well, but we have to look after these girls, and if we don't do something, they will do something worse somewhere else. But, you know, then you're going to destroy the law here. I mean, you're going to already start creating problems and weakening the law that we have. Because if you can take part of it, do part of it on girls, well, then it'll grow, possibly. They love to use this talk about, you know, the slippery slope. Once you take one step, you know, they'll use that against people like German Nazis, but they won't use it against themselves. But anyway, I think this is very interesting controversy, and it shows how ready these people are to cater to these foreign religions and foreign barbaric practices. So again, of course, though he was highly criticized for that, highly criticized, which is good, because people do not want these operations done on girls here at all, and we need to expand it to the boys. So that's the end of what I can say about circumcision today, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll be back in 5 minutes for the second part of the show.
Dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit, für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich. Und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on October 1st, 2012, and I am Carolyn Yeager. You know, I said I was finished with the circumcision, but I think I want to say a couple more things, and that is that I was telling that story about the fellow Mike, the teacher, who went along with these two boys that were getting them their circumcisions done all on their own, no parents around. He was kind of their mentor for that. I don't know just quite how secretive these boys were about what they were doing, but I guess they had a doctor's permission. They had been diagnosed by a doctor, and this doctor who did the circumcision allowed this Mike to photograph it and everything. And I said that he was, I was remembering during the break that he was called their gym teacher or their physical education teacher. And they had come to him for advice, and he had arranged this circumcision for them. Although the one boy, he said that the one boy's mother approved. He didn't say anything about the other boy, so you have to kind of wonder. But they both had some kind of a malady. I don't know if it required them to be circumcised, but that's what they were doing, and they were, you know, mid-teens. So, strange kind of stuff. Now there's, before I go on, I don't want to miss reading this little short blurb from The Onion, because while I'm talking about this stuff, these fetishists and these creepy guys who, want to watch circumcisions and talk about them and discuss them in detail and so on and look at films about them being done. That's all new to me, and I find it quite shocking and ridiculous and revolting. But it's not unknown. Now, here's an article from The Onion, and you know, The Onion is a satirical, writes things that aren't true as though they are true. And it says here, it has this little story somebody sent me recently, I guess, but I don't know. It's about creepy middle school gym teachers. And it says, Washington Dateline, following a recent statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. This must be recent because this statement did. We were talking about that. This statement came out not long ago. Just came out. Touting the benefits of circumcision, the nation's creepy middle school gym teachers have also announced their support for the procedure. And they have a picture with this article of these three men standing there, all three very different looking, but kind of weird. They're all three examples of gym teachers who are announcing this. They're part of this group. They announced their support for the procedure, declaring it the more hygienic and aesthetically preferable alternative. We just want to see healthy, happy boys out there, unencumbered by unsightly folds of loose foreskin, creepy middle school gym teacher spokesman Mr. Griffin said at a press conference Wednesday, stressing that his group did not dislike uncircumcised penises per se, but simply found them less than ideal. No boy should have to go through life with the disease-ridden flap of skin obscuring the elegant curve of his glands. The group also decried the growing childhood obesity epidemic due to its reported deleterious effects on student health and the firmness of pubescent breasts. So they pay attention to the girls, too. Well, I thought that was kind of funny. I thought I would end with that. And let me get rid of this one and go on to my next topic. It is the subject of patriarchy. On Saturday, I made a comment on my Saturday show. If you happen to be listening to that, I made a comment about wondering how I had been wondering lately if it was all worth it. You know, all the hours devoted to working up content for radio shows and blogs. And it's actually, you know, I left the wrong impression, because it's not that that is what I question or that's what's not worth it. Because I didn't continue and explain the kind of thoughts I had been having recently, because it didn't really fit the program. So I let that go. But I'm going to speak of that now in this hour, because this has to do with this subject here. And the stated position of so many white nationalist men who argue for this male superiority claim to the point of calling for the return or the enactment of a social system that does without women's rights, by saying that, you know, this women's rights have gone too far and feminism is a disaster and we have to go back to a system, even to what people are now bringing up patriarchy, which is something from, well, maybe it's not that far back, but there's different, I guess there's different degrees of patriarchy. But as a woman, you know, naturally, I have never been able to say that I would agree to such a system, even though I would like to see strong, intelligent, capable, sound-minded men running the affairs of state. Unfortunately, we either don't have too many men like that, or such men are not able to rise to the top. But, you know, what is the ideal is one thing. But what is the actuality that comes along with some of these establish this ideal is something else again. So what's important for tonight is my thought is, why should I be working so hard for a system that is going to exclude me from even playing the role I'm playing now? Very likely. I mean, I don't really foresee that, and I certainly don't foresee it in my lifetime. But what I'm saying is that, you know, if women work in this so-called movement or for these ideas, are they working for something that's going to be harmful to them or keep them out, cut them out in the future, or if this were put into place? You know, a lot of these men who are talking, you know, if you read white nationalist blogs and read comments and go on, read some of forums. Sometimes I read some threads on some forums. You know, you hear a lot of talk, and that doesn't mean there's people with pseudonyms. Not everybody, but most of them do have pseudonyms, and you don't know who they are. So you don't know who's saying this stuff. And mostly it's probably people who couldn't put anything like that into practice if they wanted. That's just wishful thinking, that they like to talk about how how bad the women are and how the men are going to run things, and we got to keep the women out and so on and so forth. But you have to wonder, when these people wonder why they aren't women in the white nationalist movement, you know, if they say, well, the women are no good, you know, here we are trying to stand up for our race and the women are not doing so well, you know, there might be a reason. What is in it for the women? The way some of these men talk and not even this kind of talk on forums and so on, but I mean, more supposedly responsible men, that's what I'm going to bring up tonight. You have to ask, you know, I sometimes have to ask, what's really in it for me? I like what I'm doing, but if I were around if this thing really came together and I was around at that time, what would it really look like? And what would it mean for me, as a woman? So, you know, I've always liked, well, for a long time, I've liked National Socialist Germany. And, I see a lot of things there that just, you know, charge me up, make me feel good. Part of it is that it's Germany, though. It's my own sense of being German and what the German nation means and how the German nation came together at that time and how great it looked. And then what happened to it, you know, and so, you know, I really want, part of what I want is historical truth too. You know, that's a big part of what I'm looking for, to straighten out all these wrongs. But, you know, even in National Socialist Germany, in the end, the women were left alone. The men had, you know, so many had been killed and they were then in prison camps and so on. And they were there without the men, starved. Abused, raped, you know, terrible things happened. They had a horrible time. They all did, men and women. But they had a better attitude of being equal partners or partners in what they were doing than a lot of these white nationalist men do. They don't have any sense of partnership with women. They just want women to be what they think they should be. Look up to them, shut up your mouth and do what you're supposed to do and raise some kids never correct the man, never do anything that he doesn't like. And, you know, stuff like this is just plain unreal. This is what brings this to mind. Like, well, what is going to come of all this and what's it going to look like? So the example that I'm bringing up in my program tonight is the New Right. I thought, well, because I was, and I'm titling my program Patriarchy and Homosexuality - the New Right? Because I read Matt Parrott's recent article at Countercurrents. He titled it Patriarchy and Apprenticeship. And my reaction to this article is that it just seemed out of kilter. It seemed like something is rather strange, and I'm going to go into that. Now, I have talked about Countercurrents here before, and people who know me and have been listening to me, they know that I guess I supposedly have gone after Greg Johnson and his site, and I've gone after homosexuality. I'm actually just trying to point out things that I see that bother me and that I think are worth pointing out and that are a problem. And so I'm finding this patriarchy to be talked about on this, what I consider a site by and with the presence of a lot of homosexuals. It's kind of strange. It's a strange combination. And so I'll just continue with my notes here. You know that one reason it's strange is because patriarchy, the real meaning of it, and it's from a Greek word, is the rule of the father. Patriarchy, the rule of the father. Well, you know, homosexuals are not fathers, and they're not going to rule because they're the head of a household and fathers. In fact, the ones at Countercurrents call family values and families Jewish and not something that they want to be participate in. But actually this patriarch has to well, rule over, but also be responsible for the family. You know, he is the sole responsible one for that whole family. That's a lot of responsibility. It's not just, you know, you're not just being a despot. You are looking after everybody and everything. And they have to then accept what you say. So the rule of the father is, puts the father over all the women and of course the children and young men. And when men reach a certain age, they, you know, go out and they create their own family. And so they're not under the rule of their father anymore, but the rest of them stay under the rule of the father all their lives. You know, I talk about Greg Johnson over at Countercurrents, and that place is I talk about it as a meeting place of West Coast liberal type of thought, along with some, you know, openness to homosexuality. And but people say, oh, but, you know, Greg Johnson is also the creator of what he calls the North American New Right. You know, this is a whole new movement for the right, and it's not just about what you say. It's, you know, this is important work that he's doing. He has created something he calls the North American New Right, and he's described and explained this in several essays and interviews, you know, and he's a serious person doing serious work. My comment is that he puts forth his new right, and it's not just my comment, this is what he says, as the successor to what he dubs the old right. So the old right is a term that Johnson uses to denote all of the historical right up until he came along to set us straight and put us on a new path designed to be more successful for our times. That's really how it's described, that this old right cannot work anymore. It does not work. Whatever was right before the new right came along, it can't continue. People don't like it. World War II kind of destroyed it. And that includes, you know, the Third Reich, that there's too much animosity against it and you're never going to overcome it. So we have to step over that. And like we step over the Holocaust, and we have to, you know, go on a different thing. And now we've got something called the new right. But he calls it the North American New Right because he didn't actually come up with the whole idea, because he's taken the name from a British group that is called and still call themselves the New Right. And they've been around for quite a while, but they've been the New Right over there. And there are continental Europeans included, maybe there's some New Right groups that are actually in European, some of the European countries. Or maybe they all just join up together with the one in Britain. I'm not sure. The one in Britain is the best known. And they've been meeting for quite a while, but they're not big. You know, even though they get a lot of attention among white nationalists, they're still not a big number. Of course, none of this is big numbers, really. So, what else I'd like to say here is that, this new right movement, you know, some big names in it from Europe are Guillaume Fay and Alain de Benoist. They are two favorites at CC, and they're also talked about a lot by Tom Sunick and just a lot of these people whose names are familiar. So Greg Johnson has decided I don't know when exactly he came up with this. Maybe 2 years ago when he started his website, Countercurrents. It was recently 2 years old, so I don't know if he had that right from the beginning or he dreamed that up in the meantime. But he decides that he's a representative of something called the North American New Right, which is the same as the British New Right, except it's designed for Americans. And it is also West Coast-ish. So, you know, he's a West Coaster, and there's also something called the West Coast, West Coast New Right, maybe, but the North American New Right really really extends from Northern California up through Southern Canada. That's kind of the, you know, the area that, that is contained in there. So they consider themselves traditionalists. The word tradition is used a lot, and a lot of the writers who are supposedly traditionalists, like Evola and so on, are very big, and they publish those books. And but traditionalists are, in my mind, are more conservatives than they are revolutionaries. And patriarchy, I think, is definitely a conservative value. It's not revolutionary at all. And so traditionalists are conservatives. Patriarchy fits in with traditionalists. The Catholic Church back in medieval times, you know, the before there was a Protestant Revolution, and the hierarchy of the male hierarchy that was so clearly in place. And then, of course, Rome and Greece. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, as soon as I finish what I've got written here, about the current people. So then I say that why is all this being touted by homosexuals who've never really been accepted by conservatives? And you know, are they melding now, the conservative traditionalist people and the homosexual people? Because the homosexuals say that there is a tradition of homosexuality also, and this is also in Greece especially, but in Rome, and they go into that. But to move along here, I was asked, what is Matt Parrott, who is definitely a conservative? And you know, this is the first time, I've ever mentioned Matt Parrott, and I'm only, you know, bringing him up because, well, he's made a good, he's written this article. In fact, he's written two articles that I'm going to talk about. He's making some points that I can talk about, and making some arguments that I can discuss. So that's why, he's involved here. And he is, as I was saying, he's always been a conservative. He has come along further over time, but when he started out, he was just another conservative, almost a Republican, you know, basically of the Council of Conservative Citizens type Republican, you know, you might say. But he wasn't even against Jews. He was more like a Jared Taylor, person, and he liked Jared Taylor, and that's where he kind of started out, probably getting associated with this movement. And but he woke up to the Jews finally, and around the same time, the same way that Greg Johnson did. So he's moved along. He's been friends with Greg Johnson, but he's been with various organizations. Like, you know, he's been with Voice of Reason, and he had a couple of programs, and he kind of jumped around there, doing this, doing that, and taking some time off and in between. And then he has been associated with the Occidental Observer, and he did work for them and so on. He knows those people, and he's been associated with Countercurrents, and now he's more associated with Countercurrents and whatever else he's done. But he's, you know, he's kind of a I can't come up with the word right now, but he's not somebody who's just come along one path and stayed there. He's jumped around a bit, and he sort of gets along with everybody. Oh, he's also, well, yeah, he's also been talking, associating a lot with Dietrich and Mischko since they brought the VOR back up. But he is in charge of Countercurrent's new podcast network, supposedly, if he's still there. They've given him this full-time job, which he's supposed to be paid, so that he can support his family. He's a family man. He has children. And so he is a typical, conservative, now becoming a white nationalist, I would say. So there, that's that. And, These are, well, I have a little thing here that, he's that, you know, did I already say why is he joining forces with these, homosexuals since the, you know, his, because he's a Christian and he joined the Mormon Church. When I first knew him, I learned he was a Mormon, and I thought, well, gee, he's an intelligent guy. How can he be a Mormon? But then I thought, well, he probably was born into a Mormon family, and so he just, you know, he's loyal to it. And then later I realized that being a Mormon was more about worldly success. It was a good group to be a part of if you want to be a success in life, which I think Matt Parrott does, more than any other Christian group probably. But anyway, Matt Parrott has said that he couldn't make it with the Mormons, and actually he just joined the Mormons. He chose to join the Mormons as an adult, I guess maybe even after he started his family, and he thought that would be a good, you know, good for his family and him, but he couldn't deal with it. So now he says he's trying out the Orthodox Christian church. Eastern Orthodox? Some kind of Orthodox Christian church. Not the regular. And, that's where he is now. So how does that fit in is what I'm saying with being a part of a site that is so openly homosexual as Countercurrents is. Well, that's one question. And, but you know, another collaborator with the, North American New Right, not a collaborator, but someone who they sort of collaborate with, is Harold Covington and his Northwest Homeland. And, you know, that's part of the Northwest area there, and they don't have any problem, those two groups, with each other. So that's kind of interesting. Now, in fact, I think these alliances are kind of bizarre, which is why I'm bringing them up. To move on here, I was going to mention that the common refrain, you know, the reason that I am criticized heavily for talking about these things is because the common refrain is that everyone has a place as long as they are doing some good, you know, and so we shouldn't criticize one another. And even if Countercurrents is a home for homosexuals to write and so on and talk about homosexuality as though it is not only normal, but that it is a superior way of life in the idea of male dominance and of course the Mannerbund and so on, male bonding and so on. This is all very good and will make for a strong strong society and keep the women in the house and just raising children. So that's that whole idea. Naturally, I don't care for that so much, and I don't particularly by the kind of people who are trying to set themselves up as leaders. So I say, how much good are these people doing? And I mentioned on last Saturday's show that even someone like Merlin Miller, who is running for the presidency on the A3P party ticket, is going around on radio shows, and he has come out with saying that he would like to see less white identitarianism. I re-listened to that. Less white identitarianism in that party so it could, you know, be more popular with white people who don't believe in white, in identifying as white with whites. So, you know, but yet he's doing some good. But, you know, I just can't refrain from pointing out what's wrong with all of this. So back to Matt Parrott's article. The idea of returning to patriarchy as an antidote to feminism, which brings a dangerously lowered birth rate, has been cropping up with more regularity. And Parrott referred to an article in Foreign Policy magazine online that I read. It was pretty interesting, The Return of Patriarchy, but it was written in 2006. It's from February 2006. It said there was going to be a return of patriarchy. I haven't seen a sign of its return in 6.5 years now, but give it time. You know, these are long-term patterns, because the author makes a good case for it. But I would just say that under real patriarchy, women could not hold property in their own name. Women would be legally under the jurisdiction of their father or husband all of their life. This is real patriarchy, okay? They would be totally dependent on the kindness and goodwill of these men, who would keep them behaving in a way that men generally prefer. This, in effect, keeps all females in the status of children forever. And women used to pretty much be this way and be treated this way. And women weren't happy with that, but they didn't have any options. So it's all about options. And whatever the husband or father or the male guardian, you see, you have to have a male guardian. A woman under patriarchy, if her husband and her father both die, are gone, then some other male has to be appointed a guardian for her, because she can't do any of these things on her own. You know, she can't sign anything. She can't do things. She can't hold property and what have you. So she has to be just looked after by males. Often when a woman's husband died and she had some other guardian, uncle or something, she wasn't treated very well. And as women got older, they were just relegated to kind of a servant status in these households. It's very, very, very undignified. These men can keep women from having things they don't want them to have, such as certain books or education, friendships with people that they don't approve of, or things like that, so that women are not free under this system, but only men are given the privilege of freedom. And this is justified because it's somehow better for society, makes for a stronger society. I would say that any return to patriarchy would have to be a modified version, to say the least, quite a modified version of it. I don't have any objection to, as I said earlier, to men who are really capable and admirable to running affairs. I don't have any objection to that. But the problem is, throughout our history, men have screwed things up. And I'm not saying that women would do any better. This idea that, well, men screwed it all up, let give women a chance. No, I don't, you know, I would never say that, because women screw it up too. But, you know, this idea that men are some kind of wonderful things and have to have the final say on everything, it doesn't quite cut it, because women have a lot to offer, and women could possibly, you know, women can help bring in some good ideas and so on. So, and also, let's remember that half of the white race is female. If we are racialists, we are talking about the white race as what we love and care about the most. And half of this race, and even a little over half, is female. The other half is male. And so under this system, half of the members of the white race would be subordinate to the other half under patriarchy. Now, back in those days, there was no concern about white genocide and dying out and all of that. That wasn't. So whites could work against other whites, and that is what happened over and over and over again. There were some wars and struggles with non-whites, but often it was just whites killing each other, and the men were in charge of all that. So, now that we are more concerned with saving our numbers, we certainly need to have a higher birth rate, but how we go about it, we'd have to go about it in quite a different way, I would say. So for some white nationalists, they would put, I don't know, or some, a lot of white men, they would put who are anti-female, I might say, and so against women having rights, which might in any way take anything away from a man, they would They put women, white women, their own racial kin, on a lower level than non-white men. They do. They would. And this, you see, has to be looked at carefully, and I would have a lot of criticism of that. Now, let's look at some historical facts about the past and some quotes from famous men. And anthropological evidence suggests that most prehistoric hunter-gatherer societies were relatively egalitarian. And I have read that always, and but some people say that that's not true, that some of that is being disproved, and that there never was a time that there was egalitarianism, and there certainly never was a time that there was matriarchy, where women were not so much in control, but women were seen as more special and necessary than men because women had children. And I find that very convincing. But I was talking to a male yesterday who said no, because women men have always been stronger than women, so they didn't have to, you know, they could always push women around, and so women were never in charge. It never has been that way. I don't know, because nobody knows, really. These are all theories. The patriarchal, this theory says that the patriarchal social structure did not develop until innovations such as agriculture and animal domestication had developed. And once a man settled down to one place, then they had lots of food that they could store up. They could grow food and then store it. And then cities could grow and so on. That's when the male domination became more, just took place, and it was easier. It was just more natural for that to happen then. And domination by men of women, it says, is found going back as far as 3,100 BC. Well, that's 5,000 years ago. That's not so far. That's not so far back. But that's where they can, where we have evidence that the men were already dominating the women and putting restrictions on women's reproductive capacity. I don't quite get that. And excluding them from the things they didn't want them to be a part of. And it was the appearance of the Hebrews about 3,000 years ago. So, this other showed up about 5,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago, supposedly, these Hebrews appeared. And they also then instituted the exclusion of women from the God-humanity covenant. So even God now didn't approve of women's equality, and women should, he had all kinds of rules for women, you know, and they couldn't be a part of men's affairs, and they couldn't sit in the church, and they couldn't come into the temple, and they couldn't do this, and they couldn't do that. So, but then, you know, here we go to classical Greece, which was from the 5th through the 4th centuries B.C. So that's back at the time that they're saying, well, that's even before the time that they're talking about the domination of men by women. But this time of classical Greece was only 200 years. Think of that. This time that we honor and that we worship almost, and that we talk about in such rapt terms, that we say is the basis of our civilization and the highest civilization that we had reached and maybe have ever reached, was only 200 year period. That's as long as it could last. It was from the fall of the last Athenian tyrant in 510 BC to the death of Alexander the Great in 323. Now I just lost my place and jumped way up. Okay, then the Peloponnesian War took place in 431 BC between Athens and Sparta. And in the midst of this time of the great classical flowering of Greece, and both forces were spent at that time, but they had a brief peace But after that, the war resumed and to Sparta's advantage, and Athens was definitively defeated in 404 BC, and internal Athenian agitations marked the end of the 5th century BC in Greece. And the fall of Sparta occurred in after 405. In 405, they were the masters of all around them. They were masters of the allies of Athens and of Athens itself. And then their power was undivided. But by the end of the century, by 300, they could not even defend their own city. So that's how fast they rose up and came down. And they might be a little bit overrated. I don't know. But here from a dialogue of Plato called Meno, Meno was a king. He writes, this is supposedly spoken by Meno. Let us take first the virtue of a man. He should know how to administer the state, and in the administration of it to benefit his friends and harm his enemies. And he must also be careful not to suffer harm himself. A woman's virtue, if you wish to know about that, may also be easily described. Her duty is to order her house and to keep what is indoors and obey her husband. Well, you know, this is sensible, especially if you're a man, and you are in your, you know, you have the power to set things the way you want. And they say that men should be virtuous and they should know how to administer the state. Well, that would be great if they were able to do that. But we know how many of them did a poor job of it. As I said again, that doesn't mean a woman would do better. But they're saying that a woman has to stay. Her job is her house, and she should stay in her house. I mean, they really didn't want women to be out and about too much, and they certainly didn't want them in their affairs. And, of course, if a woman doesn't obey her husband, then there can be marital strife, and then that can be bad for the state. These weren't very big countries. They didn't have huge populations. And, you know, they wanted things to be peaceful and so that progress could be made, and they didn't want women to be arguing and not agreeing to things. So the best thing was to say a woman must obey her husband, and then supposedly that was going to keep peace and tranquility, but it didn't put women in a very good position, but they didn't care about that. Now, Aristotle was quite anti-female, and he portrayed women as morally, intellectually, and physically inferior to men. He saw women as a property of men. He claimed that women's role in society was to reproduce and serve men in the household. And he saw male domination of women as natural and virtuous. So, you know, again, whatever was convenient for men, they wrote this stuff. Because if women were not allowed to go to be educated and to read books and to do things like that, well, naturally, then they could say they're intellectually inferior to men. And they didn't want women to compete with men because, again, that didn't make for a stable society as much as if women had their absolute role and they were reproducing, having children and raising the children and serving men in the household. So, you know, as soon as the woman stayed home and when the man went out and did his business and his affairs and when he came back, the woman was there to serve him, you know, to serve him refreshments, to serve him this, to serve him whatever. You know, she was, you know, nobody was serving her. Maybe there were some servants in the household that she could order around. But anyway, this was the way they did it. And I can agree that this would make for, if you could keep everybody doing this, this would make for a pretty peaceful, well-ordered society. But what price? Who's paying this price, and how long do women accept this kind of price? Now, Egyptian women, on the other hand, well, we saw that this golden age, this classical Greece only lasted 200 years. So, but Egyptian women, and this is in ancient Egypt, not after Egypt, when Egypt, I think, was white, basically white, They were able to attend market and were employed in a trade. In ancient Egypt, a middle-class woman might sit on a local tribunal, engage in real estate transactions, and inherit or bequeath property. Women also secured loans and witnessed legal documents. So what a difference. And this was back, this is just the difference in the cultures, where you dominate. And it was what we have taken on as Western culture, the Greeks and the Romans, for our model of civilization, not the Egyptian. But anyway, women did move up anyway. So I want to now mention evolutionary psychology, which is a different explanation for the origin of patriarchy, which starts with the view that females almost always invest more energy into producing offspring than males, and therefore in most species, females are a limiting resource over which males will compete. Well, we're all familiar with that men compete for women, and men then became more competitive and aggressive. That's part of the reason, and that the female preference is for males who control more resources, which can help her and her children. So the woman is looking for the wealthiest man, or the man with the most power, or the most authority, you know, amongst everyone, because then she will feel safer for herself and her children. The women, not being able to stop having children, were always concerned with what the fate of their children was going to be, and their children will tend to look after their mother. So a woman having children would probably depend more on her children to be good to her and look after her than her husband in many, many cases. Now, this then is turned into a selection pressure on men to be competitive and succeed in gaining resources and power in competition with other men. But this did not happen to women. Women did not have this pressure to compete with other women. They just let the men compete for them. So now why I bring up all this together, and I have got a whole lot to go and I can't finish it, so this would have been one show actually instead of half of a show. But you know what? Where do these homosexuals come into this? Why are these homosexuals praising ancient Greece? And because they say that these were men's societies, these were male-dominated societies, and this is what they're interested in. Homosexuals can exclude women without feeling any loss or any loss of pleasure. You know, normal man is not happy if he has no female companionship, no female love or female sex. But an abnormal man, a queer, is quite happy with only male companionship, love and sex. So they really like these. They really like a kind of patriarchal society because they think that they can sort of fit in with the dominant men, and the women won't be there competing with them so much, maybe, you know, and they can get men, all men, to accept a little bit of male sex or, you know, something like that once in a while. That's really what it's all about. And yet, here's Matt Parrott, who's a family man, and he's joining up with all of this. He's joining up with Greg Johnson's New Right, and he's joining up with this project of the radio network. And I'm not, you know, I'm not worried about their radio network at all. That's not why I'm saying this. I'm just saying that. Matt feels that this is good for him. This is an opportunity, and so he has said there's no evidence that Greg himself is a homosexual. So obviously he's in denial and he's justifying what he's doing and ignoring all the homosexuality that's there. Well, you know, I discovered quite a bit about Johnson's past and I posted it. It wasn't that hard to find once I started looking. And a couple years ago, some posters on VNN Forum came up with a lot of the essays and statements that Greg had written and made about homosexuality. That's where I first picked up on all this. And they concluded definitely that he was queer. There's no doubt about it. So yet there are still people who will say, well, there's no evidence. Well, they just don't want to talk about it. They just want to ignore it. So let's look at the little time I have left at this article by Parrott. I'll go to Patriarchy and Apprenticeship. He says, this article, Return of Patriarchy, that he linked to, suggests what I believe to be the cardinal consideration, the iron necessity of male social dominance. Regardless of race, IQ, or religious affiliation, see, a socioeconomic paradigm in which females no longer depend on males for defense and support is one in which women lose interest in mating. So he's saying that if females don't depend on males for everything, they will lose interest in mating. And he was using this panda, these pandas in the zoo, who just this female panda just refuses to mate or to get pregnant or whatever. You know, they're trying to build up the panda population. This is in the United States with this Chinese panda they got, but she won't cooperate. And his argument basically is that if women are so taken care of in today's world that they don't need men, and if they don't need men, they're not going to want to be with men. They would rather not. Therefore, you have to change these rules so that women don't have any options. They don't have these options, and they then are going to be forced once again to be under male dominance and to go through all that so that we can raise the birth rate and keep ourselves going. Well, that's the male view of it. My view would be something that I mentioned earlier in earlier programs, that that women should be rewarded and financially rewarded for staying home and having children and spending time, you know, with their young children. It's taking quite a few years out, you know, now these are intelligent women who have been educated, and you can't make a woman wait until after she's raised a family to let her be educated. You just can't do it. I mean, smart women want to learn things, and we've got smart women. I mean, you know, women are the same as men for the most part, and we have all kinds of smart and talented women, and you just can't do that. At least in my opinion, it should not be tried. But we should have a society in which women and men are rewarded, but especially women need to be rewarded because they're the ones that are going to stay home with their kids. And the fact is that when they go back to work after they've been off for even 2 years, but let's say 5 or 6 years, where they take a, they're way behind where they would have been if they had stayed. And they never make that up, and that's not fair to them, and they don't want to do that, and it shouldn't be expected of them. So the government, this government that we're talking about that's throwing billions and billions at Africa and so on, could easily pay money to these women while they're home with their families, and also guarantee them that when they do go back, they won't be punished for being gone. They will be able to have, you know, the pay and the status that they would have had they been there all that time. Things like that. And that's how we can do it in a better way that would make men and women work together, to make a better society. So that these white nationalists we need to get rid of the homosexuals. We need to quit listening to homosexuals because they want to they're anti-female. Oh, they'll pretend like they're all just so friendly with certain women. But, you know, they're really not. And we don't want to be anti-female. We want to be pro-male, pro-female, pro-white, and have the kind of nations that we want to have. We're not going to do it with this old-fashioned kind of bringing back things from the past and patriarchy and so on and holding women down. And Matt did say in his article that he couldn't go so far as to say that he might have some daughters, I don't know, but you know, he said the path forward isn't through discouraging female education and ambition altogether, but through the defense and development of male fraternity in martial vanguard, sacred rites, and mercantile guilds. While the first two are indeed vital and necessary, they're insufficient in our mercantile age. Well, he's a real mercantile kind of person. He's a real business man, fellow, Matt Parrott. He's interested in success and money and, you know, and he's looking for a way to survive by working full time in the white nationalist movement. And Greg Johnson is offering that, but I don't know whether, you know, I think he's being kind of bought. He's kind of prostituting himself that way. But, he says if we want to raise male status and achievement in a constructive manner, we must revisit the concept of apprenticeship. He's real big on that, of stewardship in identifying young men of the proper potential and inclination and guiding them in the mastery of a lucrative craft. Well, he's saying men need to pay more attention to men and young men and help them and do something. Create these male fraternities, not homosexual male fraternities, please, but male fraternities for men who will marry and have families. And women, if this is all handled right, I just know that women will cooperate. But you have to give women something. You can't take everything away from them and then expect them to, you know, agree to it. And as Marina Orwell said, and other people, so many women have said, where do men think they're going to go without the women? And, you know, they don't have to cater or pander to women. They don't have to lay down and be walked over by women. They just have to recognize that we are all male and female members of the white race, and we all want the same things. And we can if we would get together a little bit. Now, Matt's other article is New Right, Old Bottles, and he talks about, a lot about the New Right, and he says, for myself and others in the New Right. So right there, he is saying that he has embraced Greg Johnson's New Right. He has embraced everything that Greg Johnson is saying. He's accepted being a part of that. And, you know, it's his business. I'm just pointing it out that, that this New Right is questionable. Of course, Matt is basically just a conservative, as I said, like Greg Johnson is, and a lot of these people are, and they're not really revolutionaries, and they're not to the level of the National Socialists in how they want to reorder society. They just want to have a larger population of whites, basically. Well, I've used up all my time, and I wasn't able to read some stories and talk about some other stuff, but I hope you enjoyed it, and come back next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.